Anne Jones with you on Conversations while Richard Feidler is away. My guest today is Kevin O'Hare. Kevin O'Hare was only a small boy when he started to dance, and once he started, he didn't stop for 30 years. From a tiny kid in jazz shoes, he rose to become a leading man in the Birmingham Royal Ballet in the UK, dancing all the famous roles you can imagine in classical ballet, romantic heartthrobs and leaping heroes. And even after retiring from the stage, he's continued to rise through the ballet ranks. Now he's the director of the Royal Ballet in the UK, and they'll be visiting Australia next year. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Look, it seems unlikely in some ways, but your parents weren't actually dancers. They actually owned a pub?
Yeah, that's right. By the time I was born, we had a pub in Hull, in Yorkshire, in England. And my parents are actually both Irish, and they'd moved over to Yorkshire. By the time I came around, they were running a pub. And my mother had a lot of interest in music and theatre. And when she was young in Ireland, she could sing and she could play the violin. And somebody actually had said she had a lot of talent as a singer, and said maybe to her mother, who she was actually a very young in this family. They were quite divided. There was an older generation, and my mother was very young. And so her mother was quite a lot older. And this teacher had said, oh, she should go to Belfast, you know, which is about 20 minutes away. And the mother said, no, there's no way we could go to Belfast just for some singing lessons. And so I think, in a way, when it came around to me and my brother taking up something that we had a passion for, she wanted us to have a go at it and did everything possible to make it happen for us.
Sometimes when you hear of people whose family had pubs, you hear of those raucous upbringings where you were, you know, living in in the lounge. Was it like that?
No, ours was very sedate. It was a sort of city centre pub. And I mean, it's amazing now, because I used to think, gosh, my father used to work so hard. But nowadays, in England anyway, the hours for public pubs go all day, all night. Whereas actually in those days, it was sort of, you opened at 12 o'clock till 3 and then 7 till 10, you know. So it didn't seem quite, it's not quite the raucous thing that you're thinking of.
Oh, yeah. That sounds quite nice in working hours now, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, amazing.
So what sort of a boy were you then?
Well, I think what was interesting really was that my sister and my brother are, you know, my sister's 7 years older than me, my brother 5. And so by the time I came along and was about to walk and do all of those things around 5, the hobby was really going to dance class. And it just sort of happened by accident. My sister went, like all little girls go, to ballet class. And because my brother was close in age, my mother said, oh, go and watch your sister, you know, and that's what he did. And there was a male teacher, which was kind of unusual in a small town to have a male ballet teacher. And he said to my brother, oh, you know, boys can do this as well. And so the story goes, Michael got up, did a few lessons, and then was entered in a competition and won the cup, you know, doing a sailor's hornpipe, you know. So there is a picture of him with the cup. So I think it is a true story. So by the time I came along, I don't think I was forced into it, but it just seemed like the natural thing to do on a Saturday. And obviously, I sort of grew to love it.
So it wasn't a love at first sight thing?
No, it just seemed a nice thing to do, you know. And but I had this sort of, you know, idea that I liked performing, I think. You know, that was it, and probably liked the attention. And, you know, and this wasn't ballet at all. This was, you know, doing a bit of tap dancing, a bit of song and dance, a bit of jazz, I suppose they'd call it. And just loved entertaining, really.
Well, it sounds like it was quite a lot of fun. And then as time went on, you became more accomplished dancer, you actually landed a role in a film. It was almost all kids in this film, Bugsy Malone. What do you remember of the filming?
Well, it was quite amazing. It was, you know, people ask me, you know, because I think times have changed so much that for a young boy to be dancing is not a big deal now. And I think most parents are supportive, and the sort of their colleagues at school or whatever. But at that time, maybe it was unusual to have, you know, be a dancer as a boy. But I think because we did these sort of television shows and we got into Bugsy Malone, and it was about a month of filming. And I think I'm the youngest person in the whole of the film. I was only 8 at the time. I got my first knockback, of course, because I did audition for the part of Babyface and didn't get it. I think I probably was too much for the part. I was probably too over the top when I did the audition. I'm not sure, because a great actor, Dexter Fletcher, who's now does a lot of things. He's a director as well now. I see him every now and again in different movies. He became Babyface, but I was one of the kids in it. I was a down and out. We did a couple of scenes, and then we're in the big custard pie fight at the end, and I loved it. And but my claim to fame really with that at that time was that Alan Parker, you know, famous now, very famous film director, was the director of that film. It was one of his first films, and he told me to shut up in front of everybody in the room, because of course I think I've always been quite a talker, and he was trying to direct the whole studio, and there was I talking away, so I got this sort of on the speaker, "Will that boy shut up over there?" So that's my, and so maybe that's why I didn't do any more films and carried on being a dancer.
I mean, it sounds like the sort of thing that would just make you a hero at school, right? Being in a film with Jodie Foster and getting to have this massive custard pie fight. It just sounds like you must have been the top of the pops.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was quite a thing to say you've been with all those people. And it was a cool film at the time. And actually, it's amazing over the years, you know, generations of friends who have children, they all love that film, you know. So it's sort of one of those films that has kept on going. And it's always on television in England, actually.
So it sounds like you may have been slightly unruly, which is not how we really think of ballet, right? So how did the change come from being in that showbiz sort of stuff mm-hmm. towards traditional classical ballet?
Well, it was really interesting. In Yorkshire at that time, one thing was there was the Royal Academy of Dancing had scholarships, and that was to go to a teacher to do more sort of serious ballet training. And so both Michael and I got a scholarship to do that. And at the same time, a man that had been from Yorkshire as well had been in the Royal Ballet and decided to start some sort of intensive summer schools. And at that time, there wasn't any of those sort of summer schools. And we went to those. And there we sort of met these amazing names from the past, really. We didn't really know who they were. They were people called like Alicia Markova, who was one of the first ballerinas with the Diaghilev Ballet. Anton Dolin, again, another great dancer that Diaghilev had chosen. And Diaghilev, of course, created the Ballet Russe. And then teachers from the Royal Ballet and the Royal Ballet School. And so suddenly we were seeing what it was like to do it in a sort of, I suppose, a more professional way. And so I carried on doing those summer schools. And one of the teachers from the Royal Ballet School said to my mother, is your son going to audition for the Royal Ballet School? And my mother thought, she immediately thought of Michael because he was older, and said, oh yes, Michael's going to audition next year. And she said, no, Kevin. And my mother says, oh, but he's a song and dance man. Why would he go to a ballet school? And so...
thanks, Mum.
Yeah, thank you for that vote of confidence. But then it was sort of interesting that they did this, you know, because I would have been, 10 years old. And they sort of sat me down and said, you know, this could be an opportunity. Would you like to do it? Is it something, you know, we'll back you if you want to do it, but you have to sort of make the decision now, which is a big thing at the age of 10 or 11. But I said I really wanted to do it. I suppose I knew what I was saying at that age. So I auditioned, and interestingly, both my brother and I both went to the Royal Ballet School at the same time. Me to the lower school, which is where you board at, it's called White Lodge, and it's in Richmond Park. And my brother went to the upper school at the age of 16. So we both sort of moved to London at that age.
How incredible that at 10 you said, no, yeah, I'll go and do this. But yes. Did you really know what you were getting into? Because what was it like at the White Lodge?
Well, it was sort of fascinating, you know, because I'd been traveling around, taking classes here, traveling there, and you know, the stereotypical thing of the, you know, the one boy or the two boys at the most in a ballet class. And of course, you go to White Lodge and you're just full of guys, you know, young guys, all with the same passion. And we had 15 boys in our year and a lot of talent. And so I think that's sort of refreshing. And the fact that it's all in one place, because, of course, you are being taught educationally as well. So you do your education, your academic work, and then every day one of your classes is a ballet class as well. And so having that combination, everything there together, I think I did find it hard being away from home. You know, I was a boarder, and that was something unusual. I came from a very, very, you know, my parents, lovely parents, but, you know, very normal family. You know, we weren't super rich or anything, you know, would never have gone to a boarding school unless this opportunity had come up. So I'm grateful, you know, and of course, you know, you get grants and government grants to do this. But what's been amazing is the people. What I love about the Royal Ballet School is that everybody comes from such different backgrounds. So, you know, you could have me from Hull, you know, you can have somebody from Scotland, and then you can have somebody from Italy, you know. And one of my great friends, we both joined at White Lodge at the same time, and she was from Italy and I was from Yorkshire. And so at that time, Yorkshire seemed so far away, we never even went back home for the weekend. And so me and this girl were always there on a weekend. And, you know, I never knew what her background was. When we grew up, I realized that she was from this amazing, you know, sort of rich family in Italy, you know, with a, you know, what we would call her home was like a stately home, you know, when I went to see them in Italy. And but we're just two kids from totally different backgrounds, but with this one thing, which is this passion for dance. And I think that's what's wonderful about, you know, when you get a group of people that all have the same ambition.
You did have this passion for dance in common with your classmates, but you also had something else, your age. You were all teenagers, all going through puberty. What was that like to be in such a rigid environment, training-wise, but also to be going through this flourishing change in your life?
It's very weird, actually. I don't remember having one of those moments. I was maybe too much concentrating on being a dancer, but I was. Yeah, there was never that sort of moment. And really, we were, particularly our year, actually, I think we were a very stable year. I remember when I joined, and I remember never telling my parents this because I thought they would pull me out of this school, because the fifth year of that year, so they were 16-year-olds, and they were the wildest year I think that had ever hit White Lodge before or after. One of the famous now dancer choreography, Michael Clark, was there, and they were caught up on the roof, meeting girls, you know, doing, you know, probably smoking and drinking, all of those things. And I think maybe we all saw, and I know a lot of them got suspended and all of that. So I think maybe we saw that and thought, oh, that's not the way to go, you know, and just we were much better behaved than that. Also, what was interesting, you know, talking about growing and at that time, you know, each person grows very individually, and you notice it much more when you're dancing and you're in the studio together. And so, you know, some of the guys were really, by 16, really grown up guys, and I was very small as a dancer. You sort of said it in my introduction, but they were really worried about me because I don't know what I was, 4'10" for years, and which sounds awful. And there was I don't know if in Australia they know this dancer, but there was a dancer called Wayne Sleep, who was a very, very talented dancer in the Royal Ballet, and he actually then went on to create the roles in Cats and Song and Dance, and he really was the first person to do a crossover from ballet into musical theatre. But he was very, very small, and everybody sort of said there can only be one Wayne Sleep, they don't want any other small people. So they were so worried that they sent me off for this test, and you can x-ray your wrist, and there's a bone there, and between the sort of where there's a gap between the bone and the other bone in your wrist, supposedly you can tell how tall you're going to grow. And I always remember my parents paid, this is where they had to pay money, and they paid something like £50, which in those days was a lot of money. And they came back and they said, oh, he's going to be between 5 foot and 6 foot. And they're like, great, that's really worthwhile. I think we could have all said that. So the next year happened, and of course they couldn't, I still hadn't grown. So they said he has to go off again, have this test, and another £50. And actually this time they said he's going to be 5 foot 11. So everybody sort of calmed down and thought this sounded like it was meant to be. And actually I then, about a year later, I suddenly grew, and I became about 5'11". So ended up being taller.
During that time of the later adolescence, did you ever waver in that sense of vocation, that this was the right thing for you to be doing, to become a professional ballet dancer?
I think there was a few moments. I think because I was this sort of song and dance man type person, I think maybe I felt sometimes a little bit restricted within, you know, because you're in classical ballet, especially then it was very much, oh, you do it like this, you don't overdo anything, and you've got to be very much in the box. And so I think that was probably a little bit of a little hard for me. And I think one of the great things that happened to me was when I was at the upper school, and I'd been, by the time I'd finished White Lodge, which was the junior school, I was desperate to go to the upper school in London, in the centre of London, and be part of all of that. And then it was slightly a bit of a disappointment when I got there, because it was still not exactly what I wanted it to be. And in the second year, they sent me on an exchange to the Royal Danish Ballet. And suddenly, having been sort of cosseted, you know, at the Royal Ballet School for so long, me and another boy were sent, and the two girls came over to the Royal Ballet School from Denmark, and we spent a sort of half a year there. And it was one of those life-changing moments. I think we suddenly grew up. We were treated much more like adults. We were part of the graduate class there. And we really improved beyond recognition when we arrived back. And I think some of it was the teaching. We had some amazing teachers. One of the most famous dancers of the time, Eric Brunn, came and taught us. But it was very much about growing up, I think, and standing on your own 2 feet. And so when we got back, I think I really felt this was the career for me, and this was what I wanted to do, and really then improved. I had another year and a half to go at the school, and really felt that improvement happening.
Because is ballet like other forms of art, where there's all of the skill involved as well, but really there has to be a fully formed person behind that artistry, behind that skill, doesn't there, to be able to wield that skill properly?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And I think the hard thing with dance, you know, moving forward, is that, of course, when you're young, you know, you work on the technique, and the technique is all getting better and better. And then, but the artistry isn't there. You haven't really lived. You haven't had the experience of doing all the roles. And then when you get that experience, of course, then the body starts to not be able to do what you want it to do.
Oh, the dancer's conundrum, I think.
Yes,
so
yeah.
You mentioned your brother, Michael, was also at the school in front of you. Mm-hmm. He was 5 years older, and he went on to become a dancer also. Were you very different as dancers?
Yes, funny enough, actually, saying about me being small, of course, then I was sort of a very good height for being a male dancer, classical dancer. Michael actually is a little bit smaller, but that also meant that he could do a really wide range of roles. So, you know, so he could do what we call demi-character, whereas when you're playing a character and it's maybe the comedy role or something within a ballet, but he could also be a prince. Generally, I was doing the princey roles, you know, so I was not lording around being a prince, but I, you know, I did those sort of things, the Romeos, those sort of roles. And as I then, towards the latter half of my career as a principal dancer, also took on quite a lot of dramatic roles, but not in the way the demi-character roles that he was doing. So it was great, because he was already, by the time I joined the company, he was a soloist, and we really never had any sort of competition. It was great to have a brother that had the same passion as you, you know, and I think that made us very close. But we just really got on with our careers and just enjoyed each other's success, really.
And what about the person it all started with, which was your sister, who was originally going to the classes? Did she continue to dance?
No, not at all. She got a proper job. And, she loves coming to see it, but no, she doesn't do anything to do with dance now.
So how does it work? You train and train and train, and you're at a ballet school, and it's all very rigid. How do you transition into becoming a professional performer?
It is. That's really tricky. And I know now in my job now, I really try and look after the young people coming through the school, you know, into the company. Because, you know, at the school, hopefully, if you're doing well, you could be the best in the class and or one of the best. And then you get the job in one of the Royal Ballet companies. That's what everybody, you know, especially then, I think everybody, I think what's great now is, with the dance world has got wider and people know more that's going on because of the internet and all of that. So it's not the end of the world if you don't get into the Royal Ballet. There's tons of other great companies to join. But at that time, it was very, very, oh, gosh, you've got to get into one of those companies. And but then when you get in there, you're back at the bottom again, you know, and you have, you know, you were the star of the school, you know, you probably did the school performance, you were the prince in the school show, you know, whatever. And then you're holding the spear, you know, literally holding the spear, you know. And so, you know, that's quite hard to take, you know, and you've got to understand that that's the way it goes. And that's what's brilliant, you know. And I spent about 2 years doing, you know, really just doing the corps de ballet. We used to go on these amazing tours. We went my first year with the first company to take a full ballet to India. We went to New Zealand. I've been to New Zealand twice, but this is my first trip to Australia. They're one of the few countries I hadn't been to. And then we did this amazing North and South American tour, you know. So I had a great time for 2 years, and then thought to myself, right, now I've got to notch it up a gear and start being really serious and working on getting further in the company and getting roles and working hard and improving all the time.
With that intensity, was there wear and tear on your body that came as a consequence?
Yeah, funny enough, I was very lucky. I literally didn't have any injuries during my career until the very end. And what's interesting is actually having injuries is quite a good thing, because, you know, maybe say 3 years on or 4 years on, if I'd had an injury, I would have reassessed how I work. You know, you would have had whatever you needed to do if there was any sort of operation, but just that reassessment of how you work. You know, things changed all the time. You're always being pushed by, you know, new choreography, trying to do things better. And but I just carried on performing. And because Sadler's Wells Royal Ballet, which then became Birmingham Royal Ballet, was a touring company, you know, there was a lot of shows and a lot of theatres. And in those days, a lot of them didn't have great dance floors. All of those things have changed now. And so I was pounding, you know, and so by the time I was 33, you know, there wasn't much cartilage left in my knees. And so I had two operations on both knees. And by that point, I was thinking, right, I've got to start thinking about the future.
So 33, it doesn't sound that old to me. Is that old for a dancer to be having a serious injury?
It's not a good time to have a serious injury, to be honest. You know, that's the thing. It was because that I, in my mind, I'd always thought around 35 I would start really thinking about that's the time, because I never wanted to be one of those where they said, God, I wish you'd stop. Yeah, get out. We've had enough of him. So I wanted to make that decision myself, but then it was sort of taken over by these knees. And I did get back, actually. I had the operations, and I remember waking up, and this nurse was giving me my pills and said, oh, I hear you're the one that was a dancer and is never going to dance again, you know. And I remember going, oh, my goodness, I'm really going to make sure that I get back to dance. And I did, but I didn't do a lot of the big classical roles. I did some of the more dramatic roles. And so I just got back on stage and did a year. And then I thought, what I hated was I'd been so, my career, I'd been always the dependable one. And so I hated the thought of, oh, God, is he going to go on tonight? Is he going to be off? Is he going to be on? And so I just thought, let's cut this. You know, I've managed to get back. I'm on stage. We were in New York. I thought, what a better way to finish, you know, than being in New York and do the last show there. And so I just decided, right, and sort of made the decision very quickly.
What was it like, though, in those final performances, knowing that your career, as you knew it at that point, was coming to a close?
Lots of emotions. And funny enough, I suddenly felt I was dancing better than ever before, you know.
Typical.
And you think it's like that, you know, when you're going to get your hair cut because you think it's looking a bit rough. And then on the day, you're like, oh, actually, it looks all right. You know, it was a bit like that. And I remember we were taking class in New York, you know, we always have class every day. And there was different people were around because, you know, New York is always different people that I knew from the dance world. And they were looking, okay. God, I can't believe you're going to stop. You know, why are you doing that? And I think it was just that little last spurt, you know, being able to do it. But I think I knew I'd really had been so lucky. I'd done, you know, I'd done Romeo and Juliet with Kenneth MacMillan, you know, sort of creating his new production. And I did The First Night. I did Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, all those big dramatic roles like Edward II. I'd done it all. And so I sort of felt, why push it, you know?
It was time.
It was time.
This is Conversations on ABC Radio.
So what was the first thing you did after you stopped dancing professionally?
Well, literally, I finished in America, got on a plane, came back, and I'd been lucky enough to have been given an introduction to somebody at the Royal Shakespeare Company, because I decided that what I wanted to do was learn how to be a manager within theatre.
I have to stop you there, because becoming a manager is loaded with a whole heap of negative ideas. What was it about management that drew you?
When I was still dancing, I'd put together some charity galas and some workshops to encourage young choreographers. When we moved to Birmingham, everything was very new there, and so I wanted to try and help people that were interested in choreography, and then, as I say, these charity galas. And I realised I quite like being in the middle of it all. You know, that's the bottom line, you know. And so I thought, you know. And of course, I'd learned things along the way, you know, so I learned a little bit about, I was always one of those dancers. I was, some people totally concentrate on themselves and what they have to do on stage. And that's how they get through their career. And that's, you know, fabulously talented dancers. I was always interested in how we were marketed, how, oh, why didn't we do this? Or why are we not selling in this theatre and why are we selling there? And all of those sort of questions and how we would go on tour. And so I was really keen to really learn how to do that properly. And I thought it would be great to go away from the comfort zone of my own world, which was the ballet world, but to stay within the theatrical world. And so this opportunity to go to the Royal Shakespeare Company was, you know, sort of heaven sent. And I had a ball, really. And they were superly kind. And so I worked in the financial department. I worked in the marketing, the education, helped with putting a tour on, did The Tempest in Budapest, did a big co-production with an American company, and worked at the Barbican, worked at the Stratford-upon-Avon. And so really got a taste of how to put a show on, really, and all the things that go with it. Very interesting working with actors rather than dancers as well. Of course, the age range is huge, you know, because you can have maybe an actor of 80, you know, still on stage, and a young actor of 16, you know, so that was different. I have to say, I'd probably get shot down by lots of actors, but the discipline of a dancer is a lot greater than an actor.
Look, that's a bit rich coming from the fact that you were the one that got yelled at on the set of Taxi Lorraine,
yes.
Isn't it?
Well, I'm talking about dancers in general, not myself. But yeah, I think it is interesting because I think the thing, as a dancer, you always have to do class. The only way you can survive and keep improving is to do this daily class, which is where people will know that there's a bar and you stand and you do exercises, and then you go into the center and you warm your body up and you're perfecting your technique all the time. And if you don't do that, it will soon slip away. And nowadays, of course, we have so much other things that the way we look after dancers and different Pilates and gyrotonics and sports science and all of these things. But the daily class, you have to do. And so even if you've had a show the night before, you maybe have a little party afterwards because it's all gone well, you've got to be in class at 10:30 the next morning. And I think that brings a discipline with it that maybe in other fields there isn't.
But what about you? Because you had recently retired from professional dancing where you were doing classes every single day. You're performing at the height of your career. How did your body let go of dancing?
It was weird, actually. You know, and I haven't really said this to anybody, but you know those growing pains that you get as a teenager? Well, about 3 months later, I got those sort of pains in my body. And it was because I literally went cold turkey. I didn't do anything. And I was just straight in there doing, you know, doing all these very manual things in the with the Royal Shakespeare Company. If those programs to be lugged across somewhere, I would do it. You know, all of that sort of even helped with some of the scenery things, just to get a grip on what it was to run a company. But suddenly I got these sort of really odd pains, and I think it was just my body going, oh God, this is it. It's not, I'm not doing the same things that I've done for the last 20-30 years. And interestingly, I thought I was going to miss the performing because, you know, as I said, from a kid, I always wanted to be the center of attention and performing. And I loved, you know, I wasn't somebody that really, really wanted to, you know, rehearse for hours and hours and hours. I couldn't wait to get out there and perform in front of people. And so I thought I would miss that. But actually, then what I did miss was the sweating and the daily physical exertion that you do as a dancer. And that took a lot of time to get used to.
Well, maybe those sort of pains were grieving pains for your body.
Yeah, maybe, because people do talk about it. We have this thing called the Dancers Career Development, and that's now to help dancers when they are making the transition into whatever else they're going to go to. And we have a fund that helps them to re-educate themselves in whatever they want to do. And some of the people that help people talk through it talk about it as grieving, actually, and saying you're grieving for your career. You know.
You're saying those words, you don't look like you're grieving.
No, I did it when they said that. I was like, I never did grieve, I have to say. I think I'm quite practical, so I just got on with it. And, you know, it's like being a footballer. You know you're going to have to stop and you're going to have to find something else to do, you know. We just don't have the same money as footballers.
But also, do you think that part of that was the fact that you had this next vocation that you were going into? You'd already identified in your head that you enjoyed being part of the production element, the bringing this to the public. Yeah. And so you had something ready to go.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm really lucky in that because a lot of people don't have that. And I just knew it immediately that this is what I wanted to do. And really very much I was at that point thinking management, administration, doing all of that. Wasn't thinking, you know, artistic director or anything like that. It was just loved all of that sort of side of it and loved giving back as well, you know, and things that I'd learned over the years. And, you know, even simple things when I was the company manager, just how I remembered some of the people looking after the dancers of the, you know, in my time, sort of trying to do that to the dancers of today.
Okay, so what's more exhausting, being the director like you are now or being at the top of your game as, you know, a soloist out there performing at a really high level every night plus class?
Yeah, to be absolutely honest, the dancer. I mean, I work ridiculous hours. I sometimes come in at 9, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, and I might leave at 1 o'clock in the, you know, if there's the show, and then I have to see some sponsors and do whatever, you know, so the day, and literally not a break in there. And I try to get in the studio when I can, and it's meeting, blah, blah, blah. But I'm never as tired as I was. That exhaustion that you are as a dancer, both mentally and physically.
Has that changed the way you sleep?
Yeah, I do less sleep now. At least as a dancer, you know, and oh my goodness, you know, the weekend, if you had a Sunday where you would just sleep for hours and hours and hours and get up and then go back to sleep, because just the body just needed to recharge again. I suppose I was never really, I was more of a night person, but now I'm both. I'm up early and then to bed late.
To a British person, what does the Royal Ballet actually mean if you said that?
I think it does create something imagination in the air of hopefully a quality I suddenly qualify that, but you know, just of a quality product, something that the people of at the top of their game performing and in the highest level of classical ballet. And I would hope that in the last few years think of us being very creative in pushing the art form forward, as well as respecting it. Famously, our founder, who is called Dame Ninette de Valois, she always used to say about, you know, you have to respect the past, look to the future, but also concentrate on the present. And I think, you know, that's what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do now is it's hard because we've got this wonderful repertoire, and why people, I think, love the Royal Ballet and why dancers want to be part of the Royal Ballet is that we have this huge breadth of repertoire. So we have the classics, the ones that everybody knows, the Nutcrackers, the Swan Lakes, Sleeping Beauties. Then we have two choreographers that shaped the company, which was Sir Frederick Ashton and Sir Kenneth Macmillan. And so they really shaped in a new way and pushed us forward. And these ballets are, you know, that they created or danced by companies all around the world now. And so then I've been trying to, with our new choreographers, Wayne McGregor, who's our resident choreographer, Christopher Wheeldon, who's our artistic associate, and also Liam Scarlett, who's our artist in resident. So we have these three choreographers, and they're, now I'm wanting them to shape the company in new ways of pushing the art form forward.
Where your house is, the Opera House, is just amazing, and it's sort of like a fairy tale place. How do you describe it?
We call it the house, you know, and hopefully that means that it's somewhere that people feel comfortable in. It's like a home, you know, and it's amazing. I mean, this building houses, you know, 800 people or more working there every day, creating, because it's obviously opera and ballet. And we have 100 dancers. We have, you know, all our staff and everybody. So we're about 200 connected with the Royal Ballet completely. But then we have all our press and marketing and therefore the whole of the Opera House. So the Royal Ballet is very much like a family. You know, of course, I'm working with people that I've known all my life. You know, there's one of the guys that's in now does the scheduling, and he also performs still character roles on stage. He's known me since I was 11, you know.
So he's got a lot of dirt.
Yeah, and he's from Barnsley, you know, down around the corner, you know. And then even those people, you know, the big names like Sir Peter Wright and, you know, Monica Mason and Anthony Down, they've all known me since I was 11. So it's this weird thing of big organization, but in the end, a family.
But it isn't all as simple as that, right? Because you came up through the Royal Ballet School, but then you veered off to the Birmingham Royal Ballet, which used to be Sadler's Wells.
Yes, yeah.
And now you've come back to the Royal Ballet, but is there a bit of sort of tribalism that goes on between the two? Because they've both got royal in title, which might confuse people, but they're two separate identities.
Now they are. When I was there with the Sadler's Wells Royal Ballet and for the first years in Birmingham, it was still run by the Royal Opera House. But then after it settled into Birmingham, then they became separate companies. So we're sister companies, but we are very different. And it was a big decision when I became the company manager in Birmingham, and then I wondered whether I should apply for the job in London. It was a huge decision, probably bigger than when I even decided to stop dancing, because that company had been my life, you know, for all those years. But then I just felt within that role I could maybe develop more if I was in a bigger company and around different people. And so it was a huge decision, but one that I'm obviously now grateful I did.
What was the reaction from the Birmingham people? Because you left them in the lurch to take up another position.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose they would have been disappointed. I'd hoped that maybe I could have gone on to be maybe the administrative director there in time to come. But I just felt this point in my career, and if I wanted to keep on learning, I thought I'm going to learn more. I knew everything I could know. I mean, everything always changes, but I knew so much about that company that I thought to go somewhere else and to push myself even more would be the right thing to do.
Now, there has been a number of circles in your life, and they coming back quite often to the ballet school, because now in your position you get to go and view these young dancers and potentially select dancers to come to dance with your company. So did that bring back the memories of your adolescence, the first time you had to go back and look at these students?
I'm always very kind to the ones that are small, because I know what it felt like. It was very weird. When I first went, actually, while I was still dancing, they asked me to be a governor, and they were trying to get younger people to be on the board, and Darcy Bustle was still dancing at the time, and so they asked me from Birmingham and Darcy from London to go and be governors. And the first time I went back to White Lodge, and it looked just the same as I left it, you know, and it was really, you know, obviously the teaching and everything was good, but the building was really in a bad state. And so since then, in the last sort of 15 years, there's been total redevelopment of White Lodge, the junior school, and then building a new upper school right beside the Opera House with a bridge across, which is called the Bridge of Aspiration. Some people call it the Bridge of Perspiration. and it's the idea of the, you know, the students going across there and hopefully becoming a part of the company. I take it very seriously, you know, and these young people wanting jobs and needing jobs, and we have a fantastic rate of employment, 100% across, you know, not all into the Royal Ballet or Birmingham Royal Ballet, but in companies worldwide. And most companies you go to, there'll be a Royal Ballet dancer there somewhere, so, which is fantastic. But I remember what it felt like, you know, hoping you'd get chosen, hoping you'd get a job. And so I really try and do that as sensitively as possible. And I'm pleased now I've introduced a sort of an apprentice program. Somebody has sponsored it, somebody called Odie Ebsen, and it's called the Odie Ebsen Young Dancers. So it gives me the opportunity to bring about five or six dancers into the company for a year. And hopefully within that year, contracts become available, so then I can give them jobs within the company. Otherwise, those dancers would have had to have gone other places.
But how do you select? Because surely all of these gorgeous young dancers are gorgeous young dancers, you know, with highly developed skills. They've put years of training. And how, what is it that you look for that will make one person stand out above the rest?
For me, I always say it's, I want to see them dance. I want to see them move across the floor. And I think, you know, so that means, you know, things, I think that's what would appeal to anybody. I want those people to be moved by the dancer I choose. And I don't think that doesn't mean the technical things that we, that as a supposedly expert would think, you know, the technique, that if a leg is high or a beautiful shape or all of those things are all lovely, but it's about being able to move and dance with the music. And musicality is a great thing to have, and some people are naturally musical, and I think that really makes a dancer be able to be free enough just to dance to the music, and that's what's important.
Of course, over the last couple of years, well, probably over the last decade really, ballet has come under fire for having very wafer-thin females especially. Mm-hmm. Is that something that is becoming less needed now? Is there more flexibility with the body types that you can have in a classical ballet company now?
Yes, I think so. And I think what we're very keen on is supporting the dancers, you know. So when I took over, I saw this as a great opportunity to redo the healthcare suite. Monica Mason, who was the director before me, was very keen on, helped very much with rehabbing. So I thought this was a moment to do something in her name. And so I got some people together to help fund this. And so we now have the Dame Monica Mason Healthcare Suite. But in that, we have people, not only the physios and the masseurs and the you know, sports scientists and Pilates teachers, but we do have nutritionists that come and check the dancers that they're okay, a psychologist, a sports psychologist. And so in that way, really making sure that everybody feels supported. And if they are looking, you know, thinner, partly it's to do with sometimes a lot of work. So then I would say, somebody else would say, maybe just check your diet, check what's going on. And that way we have a pathway that people can go through and to make sure, because I want people to leave the Royal Ballet when they've had their career and to be as healthy as the day they walked in.
You're bringing out works for us to enjoy in Australia next year, one section of which is called Wolf Works, which is about Virginia Woolf, or based off some of her works. But how can such a sort of a literary giant, I suppose. How can her works be translated into wordless stage?
It is. That was probably my question when I first thought the idea, when Wayne came with the idea. It's absolutely fascinating. It is one of those things that you just think, how can somebody bring to life the work of this artist? And I think the abstract nature of some of Wayne's movement, filled with the emotion of the dancers, really sort of gets to the heart of her writing and her life. And what's wonderful about this, it's a new way of doing a three-act ballet, which is not telling a story from beginning to end, but taking elements of her life and the stories and portraying them in different ways through the three different movements. So the first act, you have sort of elements of her life and the book Mrs. Dalloway. The last is actually start with the suicide note. We've got Gillian Anderson reads it out on an audio, and then that's integrated with the music, and that's connected with The Waves, which is another novel. And then in the middle you have Orlando, which he's sort of gone a bit crazy, and it's like Orlando meets sci-fi, and that's where they're really pushing the dancers to the limit. So it's like three different ballets, but within the same theme and the same, and you can follow through the ideas, and they all relate to each other, but all individually exciting and moving.
Is it something that you have to either know Wolf's work or know ballet to be able to understand?
Not at all. Not at all. I think it's so accessible. It's really one of those that hits you in the stomach. You know, as you say, you know, people go, oh, gosh, what's this? Will it work? And when we did it after the first night, literally there were queues outside. We had to start the performances late because people were trying to get tickets. And it's one of those that hits you emotionally. The music by Max Richter is absolutely gorgeous and sort of tells the stories for you as well. It's a very moving experience, actually, to see it.
Now, you were mentioning a name there, Wayne, and you were referring to the choreographer, Wayne McGregor. Mm-hmm. Now, I was looking around to see if I could find a little video of bits and pieces of the ballets that you're bringing out. And we found this section of Wayne McGregor giving instructions to a dancer. And I just want to play you a little bit now so that we can have a listen.
Can we just keep going just after that? So a little whoom, great. And then a new idea, right? Dan tai hyun ba an dai um. Yeah, new idea. Jiang tai, tai, tai hyun ba. Wei tia, a bit longer, Eddie. Chum. Bum aum. Ha. Tiang tai hra. Bit lower in the hips, a bit lower in the hips. Let's get the hips down if you can. Bum fua, that's it, gorgeous. Tiam. Great. Tiam. Bei. Tiam.
What does he mean by all of those sounds?
Didn't you understand it? I knew exactly what you were saying. No, we do laugh a little bit because, of course, Wayne, unusually, is to be the resident choreographer for the Royal Ballet, but doesn't come from a ballet background. He comes from a very contemporary dance background. And so whereas some choreographers would say, because all the expressions, all the terms are French that we use because that's where classical ballet started in France. So we would say glissade, jeté, pas de bourrée, all of these things, but he doesn't use those, and he just goes way bay, but gets the feeling of the movement with the dancers, and they do laugh because supposedly at one point quite recently he did say glissade, and everyone's like, oh my god, he's used a ballet term, you know. But he it's just the way, when you see the physicality of the way he says that movement with the way he's moving his body, and then that translates. It's a very collaborative approach with the dancers, and it's also unbelievably sort of mind-bogglingly difficult the way he puts the steps together, and they have to be so smart, the dancers, and some of them, you know, just can't get enough of it, you know, like one of our dancers, Sarah Lamb. I mean, she's incredible, and she just can pick up the exercise, the steps before he's really created them. And what he does is he creates lots and lots of steps and then pars it down till you get the ballet in the end, you know. So it's a very unusual way of working.
When you hear Wayne McGregor sort of describing the texture of movements through those sounds, does it make you hear his passion and want to jump back up and get involved again?
no, in the best possible sense of the word. I honestly sit in awe of those dancers. When I see them doing what they do in Wayne's work, it's so incredible. We just celebrated his 10th anniversary as resident choreographer, and so we had this amazing mixed program at the Opera House, and we finished with the ballet that Mark Ronson did the music to, and so we had rock band on stage and everything, and they were just incredible, you know, rocking the place down. And then 3 days later, we're doing the Nutcracker, and they're looking like the most classical ballet dancers you've ever seen. So that's, I honestly sit in awe and can't believe I ever did any of it, you know.
Well, Kevin, thank you for coming in and speaking with us today.
Thank you.
This is Conversations on ABC Radio. On air, online, and podcast.
Kevin O'Hare is the director of the Royal Ballet, and the ballet will be performing at QPAC in Brisbane next year. They'll be doing two performances, Wolf Works, based on the writings of Virginia Woolf, and The Winter's Tale. It's the first time that these works will have been performed outside London, and we're going to put the details up on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. That's it from me on Conversations. Thanks for your company this past couple of weeks. I'm Anne Jones.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.